They led the man to a spot at the middle of the field. A soccer field, grass, with mainly dirt around the center where the players spent most of the game. There was a special section for the handicapped on the far side, a section for women. The orphans were walking up and down the bleachers on my side selling candy and cigarettes. A couple of older men carried whips. They wore grenade launchers on their backs. "The people are coming," a voice was saying into the loudspeaker, and the voice was right. The people were streaming in and taking their seats, not with any great enthusiasm, as far as I could tell. They were kind of shuffling in. I probably had more enthusiasm than anybody. I had a special seat. They'd put me in the grass at the edge of the field. In America, I would have been on the sidelines, at the 50-yard line with the coaches. "Come sit with us," they'd said. "You are our honored guest." A white Toyota Hilux drove onto the field, and four men wearing green hoods climbed out of the back. There was a fifth man, a prisoner, no hood, sitting in the bed of the truck. The hooded men laid their man in the grass just off midfield, flat on his back, and crouched around him. It was hard to see. The man on his back was docile. There was no struggle at all. The voice on the loudspeaker said he was a pickpocket.
"Nothing that is being done here is against God's law," the voice said.
The green hoods appeared busy, and one of them stood up. He held the man's severed right hand in the air, displaying it for the crowd. He was holding it up by its middle finger, moving in a semicircle so everyone could see, the handicapped and the women. Then he pulled his hood back, revealing his face, and he took a breath. He tossed the hand into the grass and gave a little shrug. I couldn't tell if the pickpocket had been given any sort of anesthesia. He wasn't screaming. His eyes were open very wide, and as the men with the hoods lifted him back into the bed of the Hilux, he stared at the stump of his hand. I took notes the whole time. I looked back at the crowd, and it was remarkably calm, unfeeling almost, which wasn't really surprising after all they'd been through. A small drama with the orphans was unfolding in the stands. They were getting crazy, and one of the guards was beating them with his whip. "Get back," he was saying, drawing the whip over his head. The orphans cowered. I thought that was it, but as it turned out, the amputation was just a warm-up. Another Toyota Hilux, this one maroon, rumbled onto midfield, carrying a group of long-haired men with guns, the long hair coming out of their white turbans. They had a blindfolded man with them. The Taliban were known for a lot of things, and the Hilux was one, jacked up and fast and menacing. They had conquered most of the country with them. You saw a Hilux, and you could be sure that something bad was going to happen.
"The people are coming," the voice said again into the speaker, louder now and more excited. "The people are coming to see with their own eyes what Sharia means."
The men with guns led the blindfolded man from the truck and walked him to midfield and sat him down in the dirt. His head and body were wrapped in a dull gray blanket, all of a piece. Seated there in the dirt at midfield at the Kabul Sports Stadium, he didn't look much like a man at all, more like a sack of flour. In that outfit, it was difficult even to tell which way he was facing. His name was Atikullah, one of the Talibs said. The man who had pulled his hood back was standing at midfield, facing the crowd. The voice on the loudspeaker introduced him as Mulvi Abdul Rahman Muzami, a judge. He was pacing back and forth, his green surgical smock still intact. The crowd was quiet. Atikullah had been convicted of killing another man in an irrigation dispute, the Talib said, an argument over water. He'd beaten his victim to death with an axe, or so they said. He was 18.
"The Quran says the killer must be killed in order to create peace in society," the loudspeaker said, echoing inside the stadium. "If punishment is not meted out, such crimes will become common. Anarchy and chaos will return."
By this time, a group had gathered behind me. It was the family of the murderer and the family of the victim. The two groups behind me were to-ing and fro-ing as in a rugby game. One family spoke, leaning forward, then the other. The families were close enough to touch. "Sharia law allows for the possibility of mercy. Atikullah's execution could be halted if the family of the victim so willed it."
Judge Muzami hovered a few feet away, watching. "Please spare my son," Atikullah's father, Abdul Modin, said. He was weeping. "Please spare my son." "I am not ready to do that," the victim's father, Ahmad Noor, said, not weeping. "I am not ready to forgive him. He killed my son. He cut his throat. I do not forgive him." The families were wearing olive clothes that looked like old blankets, and their faces were lined and dry. Everyone was crying. Everyone looked the same. I forgot who was who. "Even if you gave me all the gold in the world," Noor said, "I would not accept it." Then he turned to a young man next to him. "My son will do it," he said. The mood tightened. I looked back and saw the Taliban guards whipping some children who had tried to sneak into the stadium. Atikullah was still sitting on the field, possibly oblivious. The voice crackled over the loudspeaker. "O ye who believe," the voice in the loudspeaker called, "revenge is prescribed for you in the matter of the murdered. The free man for the free man, and the slave for the slave, and the female for the female. People are entitled to revenge." One of the green hoods handed a Kalashnikov to the murder victim's brother. The crowd fell silent.